Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome back to That Ish 12. This week I'm joined by Alyssa Sepinwall, and we're going to talk about the Haitian Revolution and the San Domingo Uprising. And of course, Tosa will be a part of the focus in this episode. And Alyssa has written Slave Revolt on Screen, the Haitian Revolution in Film and Video Games, and Haitian History New Perspective. But I want to begin always to get to know the historian a little bit. So, because I would say that this is kind of a little bit hidden history that not many people may be familiar with. So how do you come across this and begin to study the Haitian or San Domingo Uprising?
So I was trained as a French historian, and I entered graduate school in 1992. There had just been the bicentennial of the French Revolution in 1989. And interestingly, all of the books that came out that year, almost none bothered to mention the fact that France had been a slaveholding country, that while people in Paris and in metropolitan France were declaring liberty, equality, and fraternity, that there were Caribbean colonies where people were still enslaved. So it started to bubble up a little, and I started to work on this in my dissertation. I was interested in how the French Revolution had treated oppressed groups, groups that had been oppressed under the old regime, which included Jews in France, and included women who ended up being excluded from citizenship. And I looked at enslaved people and also free people of color in Saint-Domingue, which was the French name for colonial Haiti. So in my first book, which grew out of my doctoral dissertation, I did a study of the French revolutionary Catholic priest, Abbé Grégoire, and he argued for freeing enslaved people. It's a little more complicated than that, but he eventually argued for it. And so people in Haiti viewed him as their only European friend. They appreciated that he was criticizing racism and arguing that they could be free. So that was kind of the first step in my studying Haiti. And as you said, it's a topic a lot of people don't know about. It's become, certainly in the United States and a little more in France, more well-known, I'd say, in the last 20 years. But definitely, it was something that when I was studying in the 1990s, a lot of scholars were not looking at when they studied the French Revolution. Mm. So it starts from being a French revolutionary historian and then moving to Haiti.
Because I do think this really should get a lot more attention than it has, because this is, I believe, one of the only, there has been other slave revolts, but this has been the only successful slave revolt that I am familiar with, hasn't it?
Yes, and to lead in the founding of an independent country. But the thing is that precisely because it was successful, all of the other slaveholding countries at the time, which included France and Spain and England and the United States, they were determined that Haiti should not be a success because they thought that would inspire enslaved people in their countries to think, oh, we can rise up and kill our masters and mistresses, and then people will be okay with it. So there was a real effort even after. So the Haitian Revolution started in 1791. I know we'll talk about this more in a moment, but independence was declared in Haiti in 1804. And afterwards, there was largely an effort by other countries to try to ensure that they wouldn't be successful so that enslaved people in other places would not want to try to copy it.
Because I do believe, and I'm sure we will get back to this as well, because in Cuba, I live in terms of reading Ada Ferrer's book biography on Cuba, and they've been talking about how the Haitian Revolution as well inspired that, and again, it's failed. So there was a revolution inspired by Toussaint and his crew in Cuba as well. But let us begin back in a little background on Haiti, or like if you're going to call it by the historical correct at the time, San Domingo, for a little bit background of colonial history before the revolution. I talked a little bit about the class system and, of course, the racial issues that arose at San Domingo.
Sure. So the Caribbean was the first place that Christopher Columbus landed. He actually landed in the Bahamas and then in northern Haiti, what the Spanish called Hispaniola, Little Spain. And so the Spanish conquered, killed native people that they encountered, the native Taino people, and then they sought to enslave them to mine gold or silver or other things. But unfortunately, as part of what scholars call the Columbian Exchange, which was two populations that had not come into contact before, there ended up being a lot of diseases that they introduced to each other. And native people on Hispaniola and elsewhere in the Americas were almost entirely wiped out, again, through a combination of violence and getting smallpox, which the Europeans were carrying. So the native Taino population in Haiti, again, was virtually wiped out by the middle of the 16th century, by 50 years after Columbus's forces had first landed there. And the Spanish decided that they wanted, I always have to say decided, because sometimes people talk about the slave trade as if it was necessary. And so the drug dealers who are here, they don't need to sell drugs. They want to, and they want to get wealthy from doing something harmful. But the Spanish decide they're going to set up sugar plantations, but they don't have native people largely anymore. And I should just say also that we have records. It's not my specialty because I work on French and Haitian history and not Spanish and Haitian history, but there were definitely revolts by the Taino people against the Spanish. But the Spanish decide that they're going to start growing sugar and they start importing Africans to the New World. However, the Spanish did not only colonize Hispaniola, right? We know they're in Mexico, we know they're in Cuba, we know that they're in Peru, and they end up not focusing so much on the island that they called Hispaniola or Santo Domingo. And by the 17th century, the French pirates start sneaking up on the western side and surreptitiously colonizing it, even if it wasn't acknowledged. And the fact that the French are starting to occupy the western part of the island gets recognized finally by both the British and the Spanish by the end of the 17th century, and then they formally recognize it in 1777 in the Treaty of Aranjuez. And the French end up doing much more on the island than the Spanish in terms of setting up plantations and importing people to be enslaved because they don't have all of these other possessions, which is one reason when people look at why earthquakes affect people in Haiti more than in the Dominican Republic, it's because there was much more clear cutting of forests. That's one reason. So the
Mind
French,
if I ask, were
okay,
there frequent
please.
earthquake as well back in those days, or were they not so
There
common? You mentioned it.
were some, yes. So yeah, we have records of earthquakes, I think 1844 in Cap-Haïtien, but in the 18th century also. But certainly it's gotten worse today when they happen. Also because of the overpopulation in Port-au-Prince, but this is another story. So almost a million people were kidnapped and enslaved and brought to the New World from Africa to be enslaved in Saint-Domingue. And the numbers were such that there were essentially 12 enslaved people for every white colonist. Now you can imagine with that kind of imbalance, right? The numbers would be against the white colonists, except that they brutalize and torture and traumatize people. And any small sign of resistance was met brutally with torture, public torture, killing people. So this system continues. But we know still that enslaved people, despite this threat, there were a variety of ways that they resisted. Sometimes there were poisonings of enslavers. Sometimes there were actual revolts, although it was harder to get weapons. That was one thing that the French had a monopoly over. But things like suicide. I tell my students, when the only form of resistance that you have is suicide, that tells you that you don't have a lot of options. But infanticide, trying to save children from being born into the system. But still, because the French had so many plantations, this was the wealthiest colony in the New World, wealthier than the 13 colonies. So I'll stop there for a moment.
So let us talk about, because of course as there were sexual relations as well between the white population and the black population of Haiti, and then we get the, at the time, of course, you're not going to use the term, but just to what they would call at the time, and that was it's mulatto, so mixed race population. So let's talk a little bit about the hierarchy, because there were a hierarchy between slaves, the mixed race, and the white population as well. So let's talk a little bit about how
So
this
first I'll say,
developed.
yeah. First, I believe in you calling things their name, which is something that increasingly scholars have been doing. So we're talking largely about rape. Sometimes it's not. You had free women of color who, to gain money or other things from enslavers, they engaged in sex work. But otherwise, you had enslaved women who really had no choice. So sometimes I will see scholars talking about, oh, they had a very happy relationship, and there's no basis to know that because enslaved women knew that if they said no, that there were horrible things that could happen to them. But yes, largely as a result of rapes, we have a new class of people who are born who are the people of mixed race. And one thing I like to dis so when I'm talking to my students about hierarchy in Saint-Domingue, there are really two ways to think about it. We've got skin color and we've got legal condition. So legal condition, we have white colonists, we have free people of color, and we have enslaved people. And free people of color could be 100% African or they could be mixed. The thing is that among the free people of color, there were more mixed people, and that is because who is going to be manumitted, freed by enslaved people? More often, it was a child. So there just ended up being more free people of color. But I will say that also, you have marriages. It starts to get outlawed in the 18th century because the French are trying to enforce a strict color line. And I'll say in the 1760s, actually, there were free people of color who had similar rights. So, for instance, Julien Raymond is one of the most famous mixed people who gets involved in the French Revolution and then the Haitian Revolution. His father was white, and his mother was born a free woman of color. And they were able to get married at the time that they got married. But later, this is going to be outlawed because the French decide that they don't want to try to encourage this. They're trying to enforce racial superiority. And the idea that a white person and a person of color should get married is shocking. So, this is something certainly that enslavers are having sex or raping women, but they're not supposed to be doing it freely and it's not supposed to get sanctified by the church. Okay. But I was saying that they're trying to enforce racial hierarchy. And oh, the 1760s, that's what I was saying. There come a whole bunch of laws that are kind of like the Jim Crow laws in the United States that start to make rules. No person of color can sit and eat with a white person, even if they're both free. A free person of color has to stop and salute a white person if they pass them in the street. And so this is going to make the free people of color on the island, the ones who are not enslaved, they're going to have grievances also. Because, right, I started with colonists, free people of color, and enslaved people. They, even if they're free, they are not equal to whites by the time that the Haitian Revolution starts.
Were there a hierarchy between the black population also? Because I know that in at least in the United States, in the southern part, if you were a house slave, you had their higher status in the slave, so quote unquote, for lack of better words, community than a field slave. But where was a similar higher hierarchical in the Saddleman as well.
Yes, in the sense that working in the plantation home might be less brutal than cutting sugar. Cutting sugar is really horrible. The cane gets in your skin. It's backbreaking work. So being in the home might be better. On the other hand, again, if you think about the fact that enslaved women working in a home might be the favorites and might be subject to rape more often, it's kind of a trade-off, right, with someone who might be working in the fields and be freer. So that is definitely an issue. But some of the kind of hierarchies you have, the people who are born into slavery are referred to as Creoles, born in the New World, and enslaved people who are born in Africa and taken to the New World are called Bosal. And if you think about it, and in terms of trauma, Bosal had been born free. So they could imagine a world that they knew that this was crazy. When I'm with my students, I curse a little more. So we say effed up. They had been born in another system in which they were free, and they knew that they were living in some kind of monstrous world. But they also were traumatized by all of the loss and grief that they had had. And they're having to adjust to another language that's being shouted at them, which is not their native language. Creole enslaved people, on the other hand, had been born into the system. So, in some sense, while it was traumatic, they didn't know this other world. And they also grew up speaking Creole or French. So, there are definitely some divisions between them, and we'll see those later in the Haitian Revolution.
So I want to
Let me just say,
introduce,
sorry, let me say distinctions rather than divisions. It's not necessarily that they're divided, they just have had some different experiences.
So of course I want to introduce our main, arguably main character in this story, which is, and do forgive me because my French is horrible, I'm probably not going to say his name right, but that's his Toussaint Louverture. And of
Yes,
course, what
perfect.
is his background and how did he become, like we said, the main cause for his revolution that would later become the
So
success that it was.
Toussaint was an enslaved person, born in the colony. His father had been an official in West Africa in the area that's Benin now. And he was born in the New World. He was enslaved on a plantation called Breda. And he ends up at first, that's his last name, Toussaint Breda. And he was clever. He ended up being a very skillful horseman. So he had a, when we're talking about hierarchy, he had a relatively privileged position on his plantation. And he ends up being able to learn how to read, even though this is forbidden. This is something that could be punishable by death because enslavers didn't want enslaved people to read the Bible about equality or other books that might influence them to challenge their condition. So he ends up becoming free even before the revolution. And then he's trying to buy his family members out of slavery. And he even had a small plantation himself, and he rented some enslaved people. I need to mention this because, sometimes people say, oh, well, he was a slave owner. In this society in which he has family members who are still enslaved, how do you get the money to buy them out of slavery? This is a slave society. So this is something that he, this was a way for him to get money, to try to free his family. But the important thing is that when the Haitian Revolution starts in August 1791, and I'll come back to that in a second. When it starts in August 1791, he ends up choosing to be on the side of the enslaved people and not the free people of color. So, just some background for the moment. So, obviously, the French Revolution is starting in 1789, and we have in the colony white, non-wealthy people in the colony who start challenging the more wealthy people in the colony, as well as the same as in the United States, colonists who are challenging the metropole because they don't like the metropole controlling their commerce. So there are definitely French white colonists who are saying, why do we need to buy only things from France instead of being able to buy them from the United States, which is so close, or from British colonies? So they're upset about the colonial monopoly where you have to buy only from the mother country. And so they start fighting with each other. We start to have clashes. In the middle of this, the free people of color, like Julien Raymond, who I mentioned, and Vincent Auger, they hear that the French Revolution has declared all men are born and remain free and equal in the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And they've been suffering, as I said, from these Jim Crow type laws since the 1760s that make them inferior and humiliate them compared to even whites who are poorer than they are. Again, Julien Raymond was born to two free parents. He was born free, and he had his own plantations, as people in Saint-Domingue did at this time. And so he goes to Paris, and he is trying to get the National Assembly to say, this applies to you. We declared all men are born and remain free and equal, so this is going to invalidate all of those racial laws from Saint-Domingue from the 1760s. And what happens, unfortunately, is that the white colonists, who've also sent a delegation to Paris, they oppose it. And so you have this would not have happened if the white colonists had not been trying to hold on to white supremacy. But you end up having an insurrection launched by these wealthy free people of color in Saint-Domingue in 1790. So now not only are the whites fighting against each other, but you've got free people of color fighting against other whites. And with that background,
It's a
this is
whole lot of messy over
yeah.
there.
With that background, so that 1789 is the French Revolution, but we call it the Haitian Revolution starting in August 1791 when enslaved people rise up. And one thing I want to stress, I'm going to get to Toussaint, but I've got to do this background first before he comes in the scene, is that sometimes you have textbooks. As you said, first of all, textbooks often exclude the Haitian Revolution altogether. But as they've started to talk about them, they will say, oh, the French Revolution happened. It proclaimed liberty, fraternity, and equality. And slaves overheard this and they decided they wanted it too. That's much too simplistic because, as I said, enslaved people had been trying to resist, even if it was brutally crushed, from the moment that they first were kidnapped. So instead, what scholars like John Thornton have argued, and what we're going to get to C.L.R. James later and how this is a little different, is that you had Bosal, right? The people from Africa, they had been captured as prisoners of war. When you had different groups in Africa fighting against each other, people in West Africa were not giving to Europeans their own people. When we talk about the slave trade, this is a whole other story, but you've got Europeans coming and saying, we want people. We will give you guns. And if you don't agree to give us people, we're going to get back on our boats and go down to the next community and we're going to give them guns to give us people, right? So everyone has this pressure on them if they don't accept the deal that the Europeans will go to the next city. So anyway, the people who were given over to the Europeans were generally prisoners of war. And in the case of many of the people who ended up in Saint-Domingue, they were from the Kingdom of Congo, and they were skilled warriors. So they're kidnapped, they're traumatized, they don't have weapons in the New World. Resistance, when it starts, is brutally put down. But now we're in August 1791, and whites have been fighting each other, and people of color have been fighting whites, and you start to have meetings, secret meetings. In the northern part of Saint-Domingue, where there are a lot of sugar plantations, where you have veterans of wars in Africa saying, this is the time. This is the time we've been waiting for when we can finally rise up and we might have a chance, because right now they're not focused on us. They're fighting each other. And so you have the revolution begins in August 1791. And at first, Toussaint Louverture is not the leader. He becomes the most famous revolutionary, but this is started at first by a man named Boukman and a Vodou priest named Cecile Fatima at this famous ceremony in August 1791 called the Bois Caiman ceremony, where people take a vow to start the revolution, and it catches on with lightning speed. And eventually, Boukman is killed. So now the revolution passes to others, and two of the leaders who emerged are named Jean-François and Biassou. And so we really hear about Toussaint for the first time as one of the aides to these men in 1791. But by 1794, he clearly is the leader of the revolution.
So how does he become the leader? Like, is it good with, people? How does he have a really good people skill? It's just or is it good
It's
orator?
a
Or must
yeah.
it, how does he rise to power in this revolution?
It's a good question. He gets the he's very skillful and he's shrewd and he ends up getting the allegiance of a lot of other soldiers who are following him. So the French, remember, even though they proclaimed liberty, equality, and fraternity in 1789, they're resisting applying it to free people of color, let alone enslaved people. And the Spanish and the British, right? It's a big mess in Saint-Domingue. Sometimes I, as a historian, have to sit down with a timeline because it gets very confusing who's controlling what part of the country at which time. So the Spanish and the British, they start being at war with France after 1792. It's happening in Europe and it's happening in the Caribbean. And they figure, huh, while the enslaved people are fighting the French, we will try to capture it and then we can re-enslave them. So you've got the Spanish coming from the eastern side of the island, from Santo Domingo. And then you have the British coming from Jamaica. And Toussaint Louverture was very strategic. He said, okay, let me go join with the Spanish. The Spanish are saying that we'll be free, I'll fight with them, but he still was a little wary. And when, after the French finally proclaim in 1794, okay, enslaved people are freed, and this is because they're trying to get enslaved people in Saint-Domingue to fight with them instead of the British or the Spanish. Toussaint says, okay, now I will return to your forces. And the French, seeing that he has been successful at capturing land with the Spanish, they kind of tacitly recognize him. And his power continues to grow until he's recognized as the governor general of the island.
I want to talk a little bit because I want to go a little bit back because, of course, yeah, as we talked about, the French had their own revolution to worry about, and
Yeah.
because this would last until pretty much up to, until Napoleon, we will get back
Yeah.
to, of course. But how did they keep control over Saint-Domingue and Haiti when during the revolution? But did it kind of was it kind of pushed aside at the moment because that and that's of course how they became successful or where they still managed to
Yeah.
have somewhat control over the island.
Yeah, by recruiting enslaved people to be soldiers for the French army. They're desperate, right? There are not that many white people on the island. And so the first thing that happens is because enslaved people are freeing themselves all over the island between 1791 and 1793. The French still haven't abolished slavery. And it's a hot mess, to be honest. So a commissioner comes from France named Santhanax. A white French commissioner, and he decides, okay, I'm going to start issuing declarations. People of the West, Western Saint-Domingue, if you decide to fight with us, we will recognize your freedom. You will be emancipated. And then when that doesn't work, they say, okay, people of the North, if you lay down your weapons and fight with us, you'll be freed. And so it's really by 1793 that Santhanax is like, fine, if you fight with French forces anywhere in the colony, we'll declare you freed. And so what happens in 1794, later in Paris, where France declares the abolition of slavery, that's really just acknowledging what enslaved people had already forced on the ground in Saint-Domingue. So that's what's happening. Just like, the facts that they abolished slavery got too sad to come back, they're now relying on free Black French soldiers to be able to fight back against the British and the Spanish.
I want to do a little comparison because, of course, in I don't know if it's a good comparison or not. Because, as you know, in 1959, when Castro took over Cuba, he used guerrilla fighting in the early during his revolution. Was it kind of like the Cuban Revolution of 1959 in the early start of the Haitian Revolution? That kind of they started fighting guerrilla warfare in the
Well, I mean,
hills.
yeah, they don't have all of the weapons at first that the French have. So people are fighting by any means necessary to try to free themselves, right? You have men avenging the fact that their wives or daughters have been raped serially. You have people who just do not want to be subject to torture and all of these things, and they're fighting for their lives. One thing that they had going for them was sometimes when French people came to the Caribbean, they were not used to the climate and they can't fight in this atmosphere where it's very hot, or they're getting diseases. So that's certainly something that's helping them. But eventually, by the end of the revolution, Toussaint is buying arms from the United States. Unfortunately, this is something really interesting in a new article that's come out by a scholar at Berkeley named Brian DeLay. And what he found was that when the United States was, when the 13 British colonies were fighting for freedom from England, that France helped them out and got them weapons at inexpensive prices. Sounds a little anachronistic, but gave them arms or sold them cheaply. Now that the United States is independent, and we're in the 1790s, they decide, let's make money. They start to manufacture arms themselves. Let's make money by selling arms to these revolutionaries, these insurgents in Saint-Domingue who really need them, but we're going to charge them a lot. And the fact, we'll get to this later, I'm sure, but the fact that the new leaders of the revolution, Toussaint and later Dessalines, need money to buy weapons so that they can meet the French on the same terrain in the field. We'll talk about the effect that that's going to have.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Toussaint sided with the Spanish first, and you mentioned also C.L.R. James, which, of course, a brilliant book that I read on the revolution. But he claims that, Toussaint all seemed always to be sided with the French. They always had this French attachment to, because, it used to be a French colony, and they always had this French attachment. But is this true that they always kind of were sentimental to, so to speak, towards the French?
I mean, this is the area that he'd grown up with rather than speaking Spanish or being Spanish, but he'd also been enslaved by French people. So I think Toussaint wanted whoever was going to help him to become free. Sometimes the idea that, right, enslaved people had these attachments to their enslavers, not that C.L.R. James was saying that, but I think that he was strategic and would have worked with anyone. But once he came back to the French, he certainly said, if you're going to apply the Declaration of the Rights of Man to us, if you're going to abolish slavery, great, I will be free in French. And he did not necessarily envision independence. He would have been happy for Saint-Domingue to stay free and French. It's only after he gets kidnapped by the French, in 1802, and sent to die in a prison in France, that other Haitians will say, we can't trust right, it's not Haiti yet until 1804, but other people involved in this revolution in Saint-Domingue will say, we can't trust the French, and therefore we need to be independent.
So let's talk about the revolution and how it evolves. And of course, you mentioned that white people were fighting each other, but when did they realize that did they realize that they needed to stand out of their slave revolt? Or not? Maybe we should band together and try to stop this. How did the revolution develop?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And the scholar Michel Rolf Trouillot has argued that enslavers just could not conceive of enslaved people as men. So it was hard for them to imagine that they could carry out something on this scale. Although other scholars have argued, yeah, sure, they knew exactly what could happen, which is why they were so brutal, because they were trying to put it down. But in any case, people do things that have unintended consequences. And they're so focused on the white colonists, on fighting against the colonial monopoly and hoping that they can control their own commerce, or fighting for white supremacy, fighting against the free people of color who are trying to get rid of the racist laws, that they don't realize what an opening they are creating. So later, of course, yes, whites are going to want to band together. They're going to want to band with free people of color to say, let's reinstate the slave system. But not all free people of color wanted to do that. You have people like Toussaint Louverture, who had been free, who says, no, my lot is with enslaved people. I want to help them. I don't want to help reinstate the order we had before.
How were the mood among the revolutionaries? Where they're skeptic that maybe we just we there's no way we're gonna win this, or where they, how what were the atmosphere among
You mean among
the
the Haitian
revolutionaries?
Revolution?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is something that scholars look at and also debate. Were some of the leaders of the revolution, like Jean-François or Biassou, were they really in it to get freedom for themselves and not freedom for all enslaved people in Haiti? And so that feeds into that, right? Whether they thought they could do that or not. But Toussaint was pretty clear with his message that he wanted freedom for everyone. Although, again, I know you want to talk also about what happens later in his rule and the labor regimes that get instituted.
So that's I want to talk to ask as well, because as well, when Toussaint becomes successful in the revolution, when they worry about the white population, are we enslaved them? Are they going to enslave us, and are we going to be the new slaves? How was, but because we know, of course, that Toussaint never intended this way. He wanted more equality, as we know, and he was, of course, he was a brilliant leader. But what's the worry among the white population at the time when the
Oh, the
revolution became
worry. Okay.
more successful?
So the worry among the white people in Saint-Domingue? Yeah. So given, I mean, sometimes people emphasize the violence of the Haitian Revolution. But of course, the slave system had been so brutal, and enslaved people were not going to become free by saying, please, can you free us? And so the violence was needed to overcome the violence of the slave system. But even having said that, so that certainly there were white people from Saint-Domingue who fled the island or depicted Haitian revolutionaries as a bunch of savages, because of course they didn't view their own violence in the same way. Toussaint decides, he's very strategic, he doesn't want war with other people. He wants this to be able to be free and French, so he's going to be able to make nice with the French colonists. And he's not going to punish colonists. He's going to welcome them back. He's going to work with them in that way, right? He's a little Mandela-like, right? And not wanting to be punishing the former colonizers and to move forward in a peaceful way. But of course, there are still a lot of white colonists who are conspiring with the British or with the Spanish to try to take the revolution down. And so one of the things that Toussaint Louverture is going to see that he has to do, especially after Napoleon comes on the scene, is that Haitians, Black Saint-Domingans, are going to need to be able to defend themselves, and they're going to need arms. And to get arms, what do you need? Cash. And where can you get cash? Growing sugar and coffee. So he's going to end up instituting a kind of compulsory labor regime, but it's not to enslave people, it's for the national good. The idea is that for people to pull together, we need to do this because we need money to be able to defend ourselves. But he's going to start to have criticism from some other Haitians who say, well, that's very nice that someone needs to grow it. You're not growing it. Why do we need to grow it? This is not why we rose up in August 1791. But I think that Toussaint was a realist. And I think that the scholarship that I admire recognizes the predicament that he was in, instead of saying something like, oh, look, he just turned into a tyrant himself.
So let's talk about Toussaint's plans when this revolution became a success. Did he have any plans for the aftermath of the revolution, or did he kind of like, I'm just gonna make it up as I go along?
So we know the revolution doesn't end until 1804 when Haiti proclaims independence. But as far as he's concerned, in the late 1790s, the revolution is over, right? We won independence. I'm the governor general. We're free and French now. So that could be the end of it. When Napoleon comes to power, though, Toussaint starts to hear about what he's doing in other places, that he's reinstituting slavery. And Toussaint also hears that Napoleon might get rid of the idea that the law is going to be universal throughout the empire. So one thing that the French did during the revolution is they said the law is not going to be different in Nantes or Paris or Bordeaux or Cap-Haïtien or Port-au-Prince. There's just going to be one law that's the same everywhere. Well, Napoleon comes to power and he says, nah, we can have different laws in different places suited to their temperament. So in 1801, to kind of preempt that, Toussaint issues a constitution that's going to be the constitution for Saint-Domingue, and it bans slavery. It says there will not be slavery here at all. So that's how he envisioned the end of the revolution, that they're going to be free and French, and that there will never be slavery again there. But Napoleon didn't like this, and he saw this as a provocation.
Let's talk about a little bit about Napoleon. What was his view on Toussaint? Because my understanding, at least from C.L.R. James, was that Napoleon was kind of a racist himself. He did not like he wasn't he of course there's a lot of to admire about Napoleon, but racism was not one of them. So he did not like what was like we said, he did not like what was going on in Haiti at the time. So let's talk about a little bit about Napoleon and his view on the Saint-Domingue Revolution.
So Napoleon, definitely, we can look at things he said that were clearly racist. The priest that I wrote my first book about, the Abbé Grégoire, who is an abolitionist, he was someone who knew Napoleon. He becomes a count under the Napoleonic aristocracy, but he called out Napoleon to his face over this. He said, when I hear you talking about this and what you think you should be doing in Saint-Domingue, I could close my eyes and know that you are a bunch of white people because the things you're saying are just not, they're very partial, they're biased. So Toussaint does not like that slavery has been abolished. He has a lot of friends who are former colonists who say, oh, we lost our fortune, we lost our property. And Napoleon sides with them and says he's going to get it back. And he wants to crush Toussaint so that he can reinstate slavery in other places. So he ends up sending an expedition to Haiti. General Leclerc is the general who he sends. And the instructions are essentially to capture Toussaint Louverture and to reinstate slavery on the island.
What was Toussaint's view on Napoleon? How did he, because he did, it's my understanding, they did try to keep relations, still keep relations. And they sent several letters to Napoleon that subscribed to this. I think did try to keep good relations with France and, have support from France for his views. But of course, like we discussed, Napoleon did not have seemed to be too fond of Toussaint. So what was Toussaint's view on Napoleon?
Toussaint had dignity and self-respect, and he knew that he was an important general, right, in the French forces, the governor general, also Saint-Domingue. And he said, you're the first among whites, I'm the first among blacks. Le Premier des Noirs. And so he's kind of envisioning a confederation in which, okay, you're the head of the empire. We're still part of France, but I am leading Saint-Domingue. But that was very offensive to Napoleon, who was racist and did not like this idea that this black general was suggesting that he was on a parallel with Napoleon.
I also want to talk about, of course, you mentioned them briefly, but the British, of course, one of them statement at the time, William Pitt the Younger, and there were talks with Pitt, I think, that they were going to invade Saint-Domingue as well and become a British. Like we said, and I think we talked about this, that the white colonists wanted a British control over the island. Of course, this would be disastrous for Toussaint. But let's talk a
Yeah.
little bit about the British and Pitt's involvement in the Saint-Domingue uprising and how this would later affect as well
Yeah.
the revolution as a whole.
So they come and they start to capture some territory in 1793, and they are able to remain in at least part of Saint-Domingue until 1798. So Sassenach, who I told you was the deputy from the French, and then Toussaint Louverture need to worry about them also, in addition to the Spanish and the angry colon. So that's one reason that Toussaint tried to make nice with white French colonists. Let us work together. You'll be safe here. I'm not going to do anything to you, and let's get rid of the British and restore. But yeah, this was 5 years in which the British were occupying part of Saint-Domingue. And my colleague David Geggis, who's now retired from the University of Florida, but is British, that's something that he's written a lot about, is about the British occupation of Saint-Domingue.
Let's talk a little bit about the British occupation and how this would affect Toussaint as well, because as the British were very nice colonizers, as we may know from history. So let's talk a little bit about the British occupation and Toussaint's relations to the British.
Yeah, I'll say this is not my own specialty as a scholar, is that period, but certainly the British had not abolished slavery. And Toussaint
This
knew
would not
that.
happen, if I may, this would not happen until the 1830s, at least, as we know.
Right. So Toussaint understands that the British and the Spanish both want to re-enslave people. And Haitians are thinking, right, we call them Haitians now, after 1791, we have freed ourselves and we want to be free. So that's really the main issue. But Toussaint, again, is strategic. Triangulation is a kind of fancy word, but we can say that's his middle name, that he's playing all of these countries off each other. The United States, England, France, Spain, it's really quadrangulation. But yes, that's what, when you asked about one of the ways, how does he become so powerful? Because he's very shrewd and he doesn't get duped easily, except unfortunately in 1802 when he goes to a meeting with Leclerc's forces and walks into a trap and gets kidnapped.
Let's talk about, because, and as well, it's my understanding that, of course, British dominion over the island is, of course, one of the biggest worries of Toussaint, but it's my understanding that after this, I believe, I'm not, do forgive me, I don't have the best memory, that's why I'm not a historian, but let's talk about, because my understanding as well, that Toussaint eventually, as most the famous revolutionaries do, it's my understanding that he as well decided I'm going to do a military dictatorship of the island. But let's talk about what kind of military dictatorship is it? It's not in the modern sense, as far as I understand when we think about military dictatorship. But so let's talk about how that it become kind of what it's, and again, it's my understanding that it's a military dictatorship.
He wouldn't be using that word, but let's keep in mind, right, what is Napoleon doing? So you've got these military leaders at this time in these countries, and Napoleon has also turned his back on the democracy of the French Revolution. He's got a plebiscite where people are, saying, do you love me or do you really love me? And so it's very similar. Toussaint is in a condition, even though they just kicked out the British could come back at any time, the Spanish could come back at any time. And he certainly doesn't want Napoleon to send troops. And so He also, as I said, he needs cash. He needs cash to buy weapons because what happens, right, when he's kidnapped, the French are trying to reimpose slavery, and he understands that. So, in that sense, he's pulling the country together for the good of protecting their liberty. That's how that he would describe it. At that point, it's still a revolutionary situation. But as I mentioned earlier, the people who were the ones who were having to grow the sugar, they are not really happy. This is not how they envisioned their lives would be after they became free. So it's not just that, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, but people are experiencing this as a hierarchy, which it was. And armies are hierarchies, right? And so lower soldiers have to do what officials say. So they were not able to transition to a kind of civilian society yet because they were still in a situation where they were worried about being invaded.
So that's sort of a little bit about it, just it's not for very long as far as my understanding as. And again, to do a little bit comparison, because it seems that most, like I said before, it seems that most revolutionaries end up being like Simon Bolivar, Napoleon, and of course, Cezanne as well, and like I said earlier, Castro, to mention a few. They all seem to become like military dictators. So let's talk a little bit about his rule as a military dictator before his fall of grace. Which again seemed to be most military, most the case at the time, of course, Simon Bolivar as well, he was after becoming a dictator, and Napoleon as well, he was, and of course, like we know, Toussaint as well, he fall from power. So let's talk, that seems to be kind of a common theme in this era, but let's talk about a little bit about this rule first before we talk about this
Yeah,
fall.
well, I mean, the general pattern is when you have a revolution, it's very hard for it to be successful in the first place. It's hard to overthrow an old regime. And once you do, which is still beating the odds, that old regime, the whole point is that it was powerful and it was wealthy and it wants to return. So in the United States, of course, where we had George Washington controlling things, the British aren't finished with their former colonies. We have the War of 1812. They're still itching to get control again over these upstarts. And there's certainly, I'm not a Spanish historian, but there are people in Spain who wish that they could recapture New Spain that's become independent. So Toussaint is in the same situation. It's unfortunately a problem, and we see that in the modern period, in African and other societies. After you overthrow the Europeans, they still want to control your economy. So how do you pull your people together? And you have these military leaders who say, only I can do it. I'm the one who needs to do it. You guys are going to mess it up. And so they end up running things in that kind of strict way. The United States is very unusual in that you did have a transition to civilian society. But of
I
course,
gotta ask you, of course, as you know, but like we're
yeah.
talking about, do you think that if, let's say, Washington would have become a military dictator, do you think he would have had the same fate as other revolutionaries like Napoleon, Toussaint, and Bolivar as well?
Who is the first person you said?
Do you think that if Washington would have become like
Washington. Yeah.
the military dictator, do you think he would have fallen from power as well, like the other revolutionaries of the time, or would you think he would have been able
That's a
to
good
hold on to
question.
power?
Yeah. So one of the things about Washington that's unique is he didn't say only I can do it. He said I'm finished. I'm turning it over to other people. So that was unique. But yeah, I don't know what would have happened if he had tried to stay in power. One
But let's go
advantage.
back to then. Yeah, I just want just on the derailing there. But let's go back to Toussaint in power and how he fell from that power, as you know.
And so, sorry, what were you asking there about
Let,
him?
let, I'm sorry for derailing a little bit, but
No,
let's
no,
go
no.
back to Toussaint and how his brief stay in power and how he would be kidnapped by the French and sent to a French prison eventually.
Yeah, so he's leading people in Saint-Domingue by 1801 when Leclerc's forces come, and there's definitely division among the what we call the Haitian revolutionaries by then. There are other leaders who say he's being too dictatorial. He's controlling things so much. Famously, he has like an adopted nephew named Moise. And Moise says, look, you're being too harsh on other people in the military. You need to stop it. And Toussaint has him killed. So you definitely have this kind of infighting going on among the leaders about what is the best way to protect us and to keep our liberty safe. And you have that background when Leclerc's forces come. And you've got some of these generals, the black French generals in Saint-Domingue, who say, now we don't think the French are going to do anything to us, right? We're patriotic now. They abolished slavery 7 years ago. You know, why would we mutiny, right? Otherwise, they're supposed to support Leclerc, who is another French general. And Toussaint is not necessarily opposed, but again, he starts hearing rumors that Napoleon is wanting to reinstate slavery. And it's certainly something that happened in Guadeloupe. And the news makes its way to Saint-Domingue. So Toussaint is very wary, and he wants to make clear that Saint-Domingans are going to maintain their independence. And then he gets kidnapped in 1802. So at that point, he makes a famous declaration that in cutting me down, you are only cutting the kind of trunk or the branches of the tree of liberty, but not its roots. And it will continue to grow after me. And there are others like Dessalines and Henri Christophe and General Capois-Lamour who take up the charge afterwards. And really, once it becomes clear, they fight against Leclerc. And then Rochambeau was a really brutal general. And at this point, Leclerc's forces, they're really committed to genocide. Sometimes people say this about Dessalines, but in fact, it's the French. They basically say these, they use racist words, they don't say black, but these people here are rotten. We're never going to be able to control them again. So, what we need to do is wipe them out, and then we can import new people from Africa who we can be enslaved. So, they're really fighting a kind of war of genocide against Haitians. And luckily for the Haitians, they're able to resist this. And they defeat the French in November 1803 at the Battle of Vertières in northern Haiti. And then in January of 1804, on January 1st, Dessalines declares independence. But you can imagine, of course, as I said before, that other countries are not happy that Haiti has become independent and they want to try to stop its success.
So let's talk about this. How did it try to stop the success of Haiti? Because of course, I think it's just early on there had been other, because whatever it's just that there were worries that there would be other slave revolts, like we see in Cuba, where they were inspired by Toussaint's slave revolt as well. But they, again, they failed, and of course, we see in the United States as well. I believe there has been slave revolts with the famous Black Spartacus as well movement as well, but. Well, then let's talk about how they tried to stop the influence of Cuba from spreading, and how this would have the influence of the Haitian Revolution.
So one thing is that they refuse to recognize Haiti. All of the other countries do not recognize Haiti diplomatically. And the only way that Haiti was able to get diplomatic recognition from France 20 years later in 1825 was by agreeing to pay reparations. Now, this is crazy because when we think about, say, the Holocaust, Germans had to pay reparations to survivors of the Holocaust or their descendants for what they had done to them. But in the case of Haiti, the French said, you need to pay us back for the property you stole, which means the land and yourselves, because you are our property. So Haitians end up committing themselves to paying 150 million francs, which is a huge sum, especially with all of the interest that it earned over time. And that is one of the things that has made Haiti so poor is that the interest on this kept getting bigger, but the leader at the time, who was Jean-Pierre Boyer, made this calculation that this was something that would make things better for him, make things better for Haiti, if they were no longer seen as an international pariah state, When you think about like Libya and Muammar Gaddafi, that's the example that I like to use with my students. They're seen as an outlaw nation. Now, there was some clandestine trade. The US is still on the down low, as we say, trading with them, but they're really cut off. Thomas Jefferson, when he was president, had a blockade of Haiti, and the French are also threatening to send back military flotillas to try to recapture the island. So that was definitely one way. And throughout the 19th century in the United States, because remember, slavery is not abolished in the United States until 1865. So you had Southerners in Congress who were saying, we need to go and reinvade that state. We need to go, and reinvade those ends. They use that terrible word because it's dangerous to have them so nearby. So, and the United States ends up invading Haiti in 1915 and occupying it for 20 years because by this time, the Citibank in New York City was one of the holders of the debt that the Haitians had contracted in 1825. So all of
And
these are
I'm
saying,
sorry for this interrupting you
yeah.
again, but I want to talk a little bit about that as well. I was going to bring it up, and thank you for doing that, because I wanted to talk about, because as we mentioned, the arm purchase from the United States. What was the debt that they built up because of the revolution, and that they still owed the United States? As you mentioned, they still was being repaid in 1915. But let's talk a little bit about the debt that the Haitian had rebuilt built up by purchasing arms from the United States.
Yeah, th that I think there's not enough research on that yet. I don't know if I think people were not, I think Toussaint Dessalines were not borrowing to do those. I would have to check. But that's not what the debt is from. They're having to pay a lot, and that's why Toussaint needs people growing sugar and coffee. And I think that they're paying in cash then for that. It's the debt from 1825 when they agreed to pay reparations for themselves. That then, because they don't have that money, is going to keep growing in interest. And throughout the 19th century, even as Haiti is trying to be an independent country, even as it's trying to export products, still like sugar and coffee, into the 1880s and 1890s, a big percentage of the nation's budget each year has to go to debt service.
So let's talk about the capture of the sun, because it doesn't stay on in power for very long. So, but the French, like you said earlier, again, you said earlier that he was captured by the French and he was brought to a French prison. So let's talk a little bit about the capture of the sun, the end, his end, and.
Yeah, well, he thought that he was going to a negotiation and he ends up walking into a trap. And so he's deported to France and he's placed in this horrible, isolated, freezing cold prison in the mountains in the Jura region of France. And he ends up dying there in 1803. So it's just a terrible end. And I'll tell you that some Haitians now have been struck by what is a kind of a hypocritical French embrace of Toussaint now. Now that the French in the 21st century are trying to show that they're progressive, they're not racist, they say, oh, look at this black French general, Toussaint Louverture, and his remains were transferred or symbolically to the Pantheon in Paris. And they say, oh, now they want to call him a French general, when then they kidnap him, they leave him to die. And he doesn't have any kind of trial or anything like that. So it was a very horrible end for someone who would have been willing to serve France and to stay part of France.
What would you say is the legacy, and how is Toussaint remembered? Now we talked a little bit of the remains of Toussaint, but what is how is he remembered today in Haiti, and what is his legacy as a whole to the island?
So every school child in Haiti has to learn his speech about the tree that the roots will continue to grow, the roots of liberty. So he is definitely viewed as a father of the nation, although Dessalines has an even more important place because he's the one who declared independence. But Haitians are very proud of their revolution. And what has happened afterwards is very sad for Haitians. So Haitians are often talking about the promise of 1804, the promise of the revolution had they been prevented from enjoying their freedom or having real sovereignty. But yeah, he's definitely remembered as a hero today.
So let's talk a little bit about, of course, you mentioned him earlier, and that is C.L.R. James, and you mentioned that he's 40s by now, 86 years old. But and to do a comparison, Barbara Tuchman wrote the Johnson Orgies in the 1960s, but today it's not been referenced in modern scholars' work on 1914. But how is C.L.R. James' work being viewed by scholars, and how is it still being referenced by scholars today, and his work on the Sandman and Tosas as well? How is his work being remembered? Because I would highly recommend, this was the first book that I read on the revolution, but and it's brilliant written, but how is it remembered among scholars today, and how has his work aged for the 21st century?
Sure. Well, this is actually a topic I've written about. Some of your listeners can look up, because I have it in open access, an article about the legacy of the Black Jacobins I published in the Journal of Haitian Studies, but I can tell you a little about this. So, first of all, as you said with Barbara Tuchman, normally books of history don't have that long a shelf life because historians are always finding new things. And historians rely on the work of older scholars. So scholars are usually reading the most recent 20 years of scholarship. The thing is about the Haitian Revolution, there are two reasons why C.L.R. James has been different in that respect. And I guess I first should say he is different in that respect. This is still perhaps the most famous book on the Haitian Revolution. It's still regarded as a classic. It still gets taught in universities. It's still on syllabi, and he's still a towering figure. So, why is this different? First, as you said, the Haitian Revolution was long hidden and silenced for a long time. And so, James wrote this book in the 30s, and there was not a lot of other scholarship, especially that was so vibrant and readable afterwards. So, a lot of people, if they wanted to learn about the Haitian Revolution, they were discovering it by reading James.
I see that, especially by white scholars. Not all works from that era, and this goes to mention one of them, William Shirer on the Third Reich as well. It's one book that hasn't necessarily aged well because certain things he write about in the 60s has not aged well for the 21st century. But so it's really exceptional how C.L.R. James
Yes,
still
definitely.
is right, brilliant, kind of like Gibbon in a way. To do a comparison, his work is still relevant to the 21st century.
And I'll add there are a few other things about the book that are still very timely. There are still white scholars today who dismiss the significance of the Haitian Revolution. And James brilliantly articulated why this was such an important revolution in world history. He also stressed that this was an important part of the French Revolution. This story was part of that dynamic. And another thing he did that was very important was he emphasized the violence of the colonists. Because often the violence of the Haitian revolutionaries gets emphasized, but C.L.R. James really made sure to emphasize what people had been responding to. And he also compared it to things in the present, in the 20th century, about other anti-colonial struggles, and he made it relevant. So those are just some of the reasons and the lively reading that the book has remained very important, even if, of course, after 86 years, there are ways that scholars look at the revolution. And when I say scholars, I mean specialists on the Haitian Revolution look at it slightly differently than he did.
And what and I want to talk a little bit about other slave revolts as well, because we mentioned in the beginning of this episode, this is the only, and that's what makes this, I think, so incredible story, that this is the only successful revolution against slavery. So why did the other, like you said, we had a spark just in the United States, and the one in Cuba that failed, but that was inspired by the revolution in Haiti. But why did all these other revolutions fail, the uprising against slavery and the oppression? So why were there no other revolution? Why is this such a unique part of history
I'd
in
say
that
the
sense?
power imbalance. So Enslavers have weapons. And you're also dealing with traumatized people. But yeah, it was kind of the certainty that enslaved people have that if I rise up, I'm going to be killed, also prevented more people from taking parts in them. But you look at the Nat Turner insurrection, things that were almost successful in the end, they end up getting brutally squashed. So it's thanks to the savviness of people like Toussaint that the Haitian Revolution wasn't defeated after initially seeming successful.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about as well the aftermath after Toussaint as in his capture of Haiti. We mentioned that the incredible debt that they built up in 1825, but let's talk a little bit the aftermath before we round up this episode about Haiti and how the aftermath after 1803, four when they declare independence. So let's talk a little bit about what happened after
Yes.
as well.
So one thing, unfortunately, that happens, and this is something that we see in other places too, after a revolution or a declaration of independence, you now have these military men who are all pumped up and used to violence and used to their success. Who should be the one who takes over? And at
Because it's
first,
always a good idea to have the military in
yeah.
charge.
Right. In this case, you need a military to overcome the other military. But then again, the transition away from military is often hard. And so there's agreement at first that it should be Dessalines. But Dessalines has the same situation as Toussaint. There's a wonderful new movie about Dessalines made by the Haitian filmmaker Arnold Antonin, Antonin. People can find it on Antonin's website. You can order the film. And it looks at the fact that Dessalines was in the same situation as Toussaint. Now you're independent, but you still need money for weapons in order to make sure that you're not reconquered. And so he also needed people to be growing sugar and coffee. And he's also trying to keep military discipline. So he ends up actually getting assassinated in 1806. And then there starts to be much more fighting among Haitians about who should rule the country. And the country gets divided into two and three different parts. And in the end, you have in the north of Haiti, Henri Christophe is leading the country. And in the south, you have a republic that's led by Alexandre Pétion when he dies, Jean-Pierre Boyer. And then they're fighting with each other also. Until finally, Jean-Pierre Boyer unites the country. I'm going to say, I think in 1821, as a historian, the twists and turns are so much that sometimes I have to double check a date myself. And then Boyer is leading over Haiti until the mid 1840s. He does
Sorry,
the.
I'm just going to interrupt you because I don't do the pause the podcast real quick, and I'll be right back. I'm
All
sorry for the
right.
interruption. I'll be right.
Yeah, and so then I'll
There you go. Okay, we're back. Sorry about the delay, but yes, thank you so much for being patient.
no problem. And yeah, I only have a few more minutes of things to say
Yeah,
about
that's fine.
aftermath. Yeah. And then my book, Haitian History, New Perspectives, goes into more details. But Boyer ends up conquering the whole island, including the east, in what was then Santo Domingo and is now the Dominican Republic. And brings the abolition of slavery there also. But he, again, Haitians continued to have to pay this debt to the French, and that's something that is going to continue to be a problem for Haitians into the 20th century. And when the international banks start getting worried that Haitians might spend money on their own country and their own needs instead of sending so much to the debt. The United States is going to invade in 1915 to first seize money from the Haitian treasury, and then the United States doesn't leave. It stays for another 20 years, exploiting people and forcing them into labor. So, yeah, that's just a brief snapshot of how things were not magic and sunny and wonderful after 1804.
One last question. Let's talk a little bit about Haiti today and how in the 21st century is it still affected from like we said about the United States takeover and how it's the poverty that is,
Yes.
and the constant earthquake that seems to be happening in Haiti. Let's talk a little bit about Haiti. Is there still if the effects of the 18th and 19th century in Haiti today?
Yeah. So, yeah, if I can leave your listeners with one thing, it's that unfortunately, Haitians are still prevented from exercising sovereignty over themselves. After the US left in 1934, the understanding was basically we will stay out of your country. We will not occupy your country as long as your leaders are doing things that we like and that we want them to do. And so the leaders
Typical
have.
American policy, in other words.
Unfortunately, and so currently, right now, fast forwarding to 2024, Haitians had been protesting against this political party that the US essentially and other countries, not only the US, imposed on them after the earthquake. This political party called the PHTK, which was led by the Haitian singer Michel Martelly, was viewed by the international community as a party that would be friendly to international businesses. And when I say that, keep in mind that because of the closeness of Haiti to the United States, Haiti is not that far from Florida, American companies and other companies have viewed it as a great place for sweatshops, pay workers almost nothing, and then the transportation costs to bring the goods to the United States are next to nothing. So when Haitian leaders have tried to raise the minimum wage for people so that it's not $5 a day for working in a factory, the United States has opposed it. The embassy has sent messages. So President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was trying to have a different policy for Haiti in the 1990s and the 2000s, again, we would be here for another 2 hours if we talked about him, and I need to go help students. But the United States has made clear its disaffection with policies that help Haitians more than help the international business community. So this party was put into power in 2012, in 2013 by the international community. Haitians have been trying to have free elections to get rid of them. But meanwhile, at this point, it's a military system where the United States sends arms to this unelected party, and then it has gangs that help keep it in power. And there were big Haitian protests in 2018 and 2021. But after that, the gangs that are affiliated with this government, which is supported by the US Embassy, but not by the people, have been terrorizing people. So we'll see what happens. February 7th is an important day in
Fingers
Haitian history.
crossed it will be better.
Fingers crossed, yes. So thank you. Thank you.
Personally, I have a whole lot of issues with United States foreign policy and their influence, but that I'm trying to stay neutral in this podcast, and that is a whole other
Well,
episode in
as an
itself.
American, it bothers me.
So that's a whole other episode. I mean, discuss that later, but I think we're gonna round it up there. Thank you so much for coming on. Of course, before you go, do you have any social media you want to share, or where can people buy your books if they have any questions about the
Oh,
Haitian
yeah,
Revolution? Where can people find you?
if people are looking for my books, they can get them on Amazon or the websites University Press of Mississippi for Slavery Revolt on Screen, or University of California Press for my Abbe Gregoire book. And I am on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sepinwall.
Thank you again. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. This has been Well That Aged Well. We are available on social media on Twitter/X or whatever it's called these days. And Well That Aged Well. You can find us on we are on Instagram and Well That Aged Well. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube. If you're on Spotify, consider giving us 5 stars. You can give us one if you hated this episode, which I hope you didn't. But we would prefer 5 stars, but it's a free downloads of some places, so you can, of course, give however many stars you want. Or if you are on Apple Podcasts, it would be great if you could write a review, and if I see it, I will try to read it on this podcast. If you are on YouTube, to like, share, and subscribe. My name is Anand. This has been With That Aged Well, and I'll see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.